It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Maryland State Senator Jim Mathias makes another bid in this November election. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's never been easy for the former mayor of Ocean City when it comes to winning District 38. In 2014, he beat Republican challenger Mike McDermott 51% to 48. 2010, Mathias won the district with just over 50% against Republican Michael James, who garnered 49%. This year, he's being challenged by Delegate Mary Beth Carosa. So how will he do this time? Well, we have the Eastern Shore Democrat in our studios this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don. Another beautiful day on Delmarva.
There you go. Well, one of the things, as a matter of fact, talk about the politics for a moment. So in the primary, you picked up about almost a little over 59,000 votes. Mary Beth Carosa, around a little over 8,000. And that was just in the primary. So I'm sure you faced this before. Right. What's
how you mean 5,900?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 59,000. We've been doing pretty good.
Oh, that's right. 5,900, rather. So how do you? I mean, how do you overcome that kind of?
Well, you know, it's great when I'm out and talking. First of all, you know, we're outside of the partisan lock-in on a primary. And when I'm outside every day, people come up and say, "Hey, Jim, how you doing? I'm voting for you." And I say, "Oh, that's great." They said, "No, you don't get it. I'm a Republican and I'm voting for you." So crossover is important. Independents are important. Holding on to our base is important and earning people's confidence. So that's how we've been able to do it. That's how we're continuing to do it. Our constituency service is strong. Just yesterday, I was over here at the extension office, upwards of probably 75 farmers here talking about how challenging it's become with the deer population in their crops. So we're here. You go across full spectrum, healthcare, deer management, protecting agriculture, or commercial watermen, small business. So that's how we do it, and that's why we're here this morning. I want to ask people with their continued trust.
Well, let me turn to one of the things that's that your opponent has talked about is the gubernatorial candidate for Governor Ben Jealous. He has talked about a Medicare for all, and she, of course, says that she opposes this. Larry Hogan is the Republican incumbent, is described as Jealous as being socialist. How do you relate to the Democratic candidate for governor? I know Peter Franchot, the comptroller, a Democrat, has said he's not supporting anybody. What? How do you relate to that, top of the
ticket? My focus, first of all, is my race, and right here on the district, the people of the Eastern Shore. Now, with all due respect, it's all about affordance. It's about affordance. I'm not here supporting Ben Jealous. I'm here. I've worked extremely well with Governor Hogan from the very first day. If you recall, the PMT, on the very first day before he was done, he went ahead and repealed those regulations that were about to become very onerous to our poultry industry here. He and I have a very strong record, Governor Hogan and I. As late as yesterday, he came on as an ally for the next portion of the convention center expansion. We've done good things, school after Labor Day. We'll talk a little bit about his supplemental budget. I reached out to him and asked for Somerset County, making college more tuition, community college more affordable. So the governor and I have a strong working relationship. Number one. Number two, also I've proven that I've worked with any governor as we come in. As a matter of fact, it was Governor Hogan Governor Ehrlich, as with Governor Hogan as his appointment secretary, who appointed me, God bless Bennett Bosman, when he passed. But then appointment secretary Hogan made the appointment recommendation to Governor Ehrlich, so I was appointed through him. So we have a long, good history. I look forward to working with him forward for the people of the Eastern Shore, but I have shown the opportunity, the ability, the efficiency of working with governors of both parties.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you simply staying out of the governor's race one way or the other in terms of support?
Yeah, I'm focused on my race, number one. And, of course, if Governor Hogan wants to come over and endorse me, you know, that'll work, too. We can have that conversation.
In terms of your opponent, how do you assess your opponent? She's been described as very hardworking, has attempted to get as much as she could for her district as a delegate. How do you assess her?
Well, you can sort of say all of the above and very ambitious. You know, when you talk about ambition really has to be, I would say, managed with, you know, getting the job done. When you take a look at the work that we've done, it's been all about relationships. You go full spectrum, whether it was the disparity grant here in Wicomico County, which is critically important, down to the needs of Somerset County, back to Worcester County and their needs, higher education, affordable pharmaceuticals, prescription drugs. I'm in a position where working, I'm a senior member on the Senate Finance Committee, so I think it's very, very important. When you look, you hear about bipartisan, but you work bipartisan. You know, when I talk about where we're going in the future, I talk about working with everyone. Some people tell me, with all due respect, that my opponent, when my opponent talks, they talk all about the governor. And with the governor, respectfully this, and the governor that. I work for the people of the Eastern Shore. That's what it's all about. So I'm not really here this morning to talk about my opponent, but I appreciate the opportunity to allow us to talk about our constituents' needs here on the shore.
Do you think you have an advantage as a Democrat in getting more for the district since the Democrats dominate the state legislature?
Well, clearly the majority is there, and you know, the push is on, as you well know. The opposition is trying to change some of the math there, but clearly what's not going to happen is the majority in Maryland is not going to change, nor are the relationships that I've built, both with Senate President Miller, my leadership, Speaker Bush in the House, and the governor. But the fact of the matter is we have a Democratic majority. I'm a solid, strong conservative voice in that caucus. When we go in and we have our caucuses and they're talking about issues which are adversarial to us in rural areas, I stand up and I've earned their respect. And I want to make certain that we keep that voice there, that we keep what we need and that strong voice in the Senate and with that mutual respect over in the House. So, no, I do believe. And I do believe last-minute issues. Let's talk a few years ago when President Bell called me from down UMES. You know, sadly, they lost their PA accreditation, and they were on the verge of needing that the pharmacy school building. And the monies were supposed to be in the budget when the budget was presented. And when it came out that day, it wasn't there. And I got a panic call at about 10 minutes to 10, and just before I went on to the floor, and on my way into the floor of the Senate, I knocked on the Senate President's door and I told him our dilemma. He knew what we were facing here at UMES. He knows how important these educational facilities are here. And I told him the situation. And by about 8 o'clock that night, he came and fetched me out of a meeting and said, look, don't worry, we got the monies. So you know, that's important. That's important, not only to give you a commitment, but to live the commitment.
By the way, how do you view the situation with the staffing at the Eastern Correctional Institution? I know there's been a call for 30 more, I think, officers or staffers there. I believe the state has now moved some of its efforts to get recruits to the Somerset County. How did the problems come about in that facility, and what's the solution? Is it simply more money?
There is a solution. First of all,
How did it happen? How do you think it happened?
Let me give you a little bit of the forensics of how it happened. But first of all, you asked how I feel about it. It's unacceptable. To those families, if we're waiting for a physical tragedy to happen, it's around the corner. I was there the day of whatever they want to call it on June 21st, I believe the day was. I was there for 2.5 hours. I saw the faces of the medical staff that came out after he'd been there almost 20 hours. I saw the faces of up to 100 correctional officers that came out. And for almost 2 years, I'm on record with Governor Hogan, and I've been effective there, calling for this situation to be remedied. Now, how did it come about? It came about, some people say, because of the polygraph. You know, first of all, we have to look at the whole comprehensive package. What are the pay? What is the pay? What are the benefits? This is a very dangerous occupation and one that we really need the most. Yeah, we're doing things to make sure that we get second chances, adjustment, reinvestment, and the like. But still, in these facilities, we have some of the most dangerous people in the state of Maryland, and we're sending our neighbors. You know, when ECI was founded, it was founded to be an asset for the people of Somerset. Now it's become anxiety. Now, how did it happen? You all know what happened in the Baltimore Detention Center, number one. You know the corruption that presented itself right here. And absolutely, through the hiring process, they felt that I was on that task force. We made a recommendation that you had to have a polygraph. The polygraphs have supposedly been the final no in the hiring. You know, we have a significant number of applicants. They pass a written test. We've adjusted some of the scorings on the written test. And when we've gotten to the polygraph, allegedly, that is where we lose a very high percentage, maybe over 80% of our applicants. I truly believe that you can take a look at that. I believe that the integrity has to be tested. The trust has to be tested. But we have been told, and finally, after almost a year and a half, I was able to get a meeting with the Lieutenant Governor on July the 3rd. We went up and met with him to talk about this with some of the other members of the Correctional Administration. And we're told that this is the same test that's given to state troopers. This is the same test that's given in natural resources police. So when you hear this 4.5 and 5 hour test, they're alleging that these metrics are the same. But what happens, supposedly, I've not been administered the test or sat in a room and even listened to it secondhand, but when the candidates start to have troubles in certain areas, that induces another question and yet another question. And before you know it, this 2 hour test that supposedly our state trooper candidates or our natural resource candidates endure, it becomes a 3.5, 4, 4.5 hour test. And the next thing you know, whether it's inconclusive or not, our candidates for correctional officers are rejected. Now, what has happened? I want to thank the families of the correctional officers. They started a Facebook page. They have had a very, very positive educational incentive to get out there and let the community know what's going on. So what has happened? I think that as the world has changed, there was a need to make sure that the integrity of the correctional officers was intact. But how far do you have to go with that? I believe that additional supervisory or probationary time, maybe more frequent trips. If you get when you first get hired, visiting with your supervisor. But I know for sure. And also, you know what we've lost there? We have lost our senior membership there. Our senior veteran correctional officers, when they've not felt safe, they made a decision. We're not doing this anymore. They're ready to come back. So I know there's opportunity to bring them back. I know there's other opportunities across the country. I know I brought a number of ideas to the Lieutenant Governor when we met. And I'm here to work with Governor Hogan and with the administration to get this right for one reason. The people, the families of the correctional officers, and the families of Somerset County, where this was pledged to be an asset to that county. So it's not right. It's not acceptable.
Let me turn, by the way, to the offshore wind issue. When I was talking to your Republican opponent, she expressed concerns, obviously, about the tourism issue, but also talked about the idea that there were some current concerns about the marine fishery, particularly how it might affect them. And at one point I said, well, is it possible this thing won't be built at all? What's your position in terms of whether or not this should be built and the concerns, not only in terms of tourism, but also in terms of the marine fishes?
Well, let's start off in the beginning. You know, this bill was passed in 2013. I was on the committee, the Finance Committee, the Committee of Jurisdiction, and every concern that Ocean City, Assateague, everyone they had, industry, making sure the economic benefits were here, I was respectfully working with my colleagues on the committee and addressed that. You know, within the tolerances of interstate commerce, we made certain that the job opportunities would happen right here in Maryland, right here on the Eastern Shore. At no point did we ever trade the cow for the beans, that we ever say, oh, let's take offshore wind and leave tourism behind. Yes, in fact, and by the way, you know, we put it up with the Quasi-Judicial Public Service Commission to make the final decision. This had to be proved when they had their finding of fact. It would be a net benefit for the Maryland ratepayer. And so when you got there on that day, there were four commissioners. Three were appointed by Governor Hogan, and one was still an appointment from the previous administration. Guess what happened? They approved both unanimously. And they looked at the parameters. They looked at what they believed it was going to be a net positive to the Maryland ratepayer. We moved forward. Now, as the former mayor of Ocean City, that's where I live. I live right in town. And you think for a moment I'm going to do anything that's going to put us in jeopardy or in harm's way? So I know that we could continue to work on this. I respect the mayor's position. I understand it. If I were him, I would probably be concerned about it, quote, on my watch as well. But this now has gone beyond Maryland. It's gone down, gone beyond the quasi-judicial process. And now it's over in feds. So we got Bowen Bureau of Ocean Energy Management that's still involved in it. So there's still time. Now, will whatever get, will ever be built, it comes down to, you know, what's the pro forma look like for U.S. wind and deep water? You know, are the profit margins there? You talk about affecting the marine life. Look, in many ways, if you talk to Captain Monty Hawkins, artificial reefing has proved to be a great benefit in the propagation of our marine life. That's what was testified to. I'm not going to dismiss any one person. I know that we have our commercial watermen out there that I work very, very hard for to keep in that port in West Ocean City. But there's a practicality that goes forward, too, with progress. I believe that this, you know, is something that will work. And I look forward to working for compromise to make it work.
One of the other issues, obviously, is education and the Board of Public Works. Your opponent opposes the change from the three-member panel making decisions about school construction, the mayor, comptroller, and the state treasurer. What is, A, your position, which I know you've talked about before, and, B, how do you expect the new panel that's being created to impact education here on the Eastern Shore?
Well, that's what it's all about, what you just said. Here on the Eastern Shore, I want to make sure that our needs are addressed here. Look, let's be honest. I've had the privilege to be, whether it was the mayor or in the House of Delegates or on the city council going fish pound, to work with the Board of Public Works. That's supposed to be a place where you go and you feel confident and you present your needs. Many times with the process, there was a real anxiety. I won't name names, but there were some local superintendents here that would call on the phone and say, "You think we're going to be all right tomorrow?" I said, "What are you talking about?" "Well, we're concerned that we're going to get there and we're going to get grilled over this or that." I said, "That's not going to happen." And I would make the call. But, you know, Don, that's not what's supposed to happen. When you're here, we go in front of the Board of Public Works for our needs. We go for our children. The most important asset that we can endow upon our children is their education. So that atmosphere, A, was not acceptable, number one. Number two, we wanted to make sure that we were able to best provide those that understood the needs of the students of the Eastern Shore. I feel that this new arrangement will be quite that. So, yes, I voted to make those changes. I clearly voted as the time went on to sustain those changes. And I believe in what it's going to be. And I believe as we get those folks in place, we're going to have a strong voice for the Eastern Shore that understands our needs as the 21st century and beyond goes forward. The school construction of today, yes, absolutely must be safe. We see the heinous acts that happened. This bill wasn't just about that. This bill was about making schools safer. This school was about making it, this school bill reorganization was about making schools more conducive to learning. I have one of the folks over here in the technical school in Wicomico County. It says, "Hey, look, I go out to Ohio and I see a new brand, a new way, an open classroom, how we can do this." So that's what this is all about, and I stand by the vote.
Turning to healthcare, obviously the state is bracing for any changes that happen to the Affordable Care Act at the federal level. There's talk about now at least looking at reinsurance. The Democratic candidate for governor has talked about a Medicare for All in Maryland. What do you see as a solution to ensuring that Marylanders have adequate health care no matter what happens to the ACA? And what about this idea of Medicare for all in the state of Maryland?
Well, this all-payer system, quite frankly, for all is not something I can support at this time. It's vastly expensive, number one. Number two, making sure you said reinsurance. Where we really have to make the difference, which we did, and we did that this year, was making sure that the individual market is stable. That is where the volatility has been in the individual market. Large groups, small groups have had a stability. Our individual market has been very erratic. We did that this year with legislation. We're going to stabilize that because I want to make certain that early detection in so many diseases, making sure that you have your regular doctor's visits and all, is affordable and it's accessible. And then once that happens, I want to make sure that prescription drugs are affordable. Too many people, you know, when I first became the mayor, I was 45 years old. And I got my honorary AARP card. I got the real thing now. I got the real thing. So I'm a stakeholder here. I want to make sure that as we go forward, our citizens, whether they're newborn children, our senior citizens, I want to make sure that this is a place they continue to build their families, that they call home, but they don't have to make decisions between their prescription drugs and other aspects of their life that are critically important. Can you imagine sitting there and having to decide whether you're going to not take your medicine or cut your pill in half? So just as important as health insurance affordances, so is prescription drug care. That's why I voted to support the generic bill 2 years ago that was just recently by the federal court deemed as not acceptable. They're taking a review of that. That's why I'm working. I worked this year to have that commission, prescription drug commission, and I'm going to work again on that bill as we go forward. I'm looking forward to going back in 2019 when you talk about, we've hit it right here. We've talked about education. We've talked about healthcare. We've talked about prescription drugs. We've talked about opportunity and building families on the shore. These are things that I have a solid, strong, effective record of working with Governor Hogan, of working with the General Assembly, and whatever the future may hold, the most important thing is working with our citizens for the needs of the Eastern Shore, regardless who's in the governor's mansion or who's in the General Assembly. I'm asking our listeners today to continue to have faith and trust in me. I'm asking them for their vote as we can go forward and continue to represent them effectively as we have.
One of the things that your opponent is she does a sort of this end of the year review and talks about a lot of the things that got accomplished under Governor Hogan, whether it's money for the J.M. Taws Technology Career Center or the West Salisbury Elementary School or the Salisbury Downtown Revitalization and so on. How much of it do you see her being important to that as opposed to yourself?
Well, first of all, I would not dismiss anybody, you know, when they take a pledge for public service. That's never been my style. But I could tell you respectfully, yes, the governor's leadership is there. The governor signs the bills. You know, we take the leadership and we go forward. We can go across the spectrum. We already talked a little bit about UMES. You look here at Salisbury University. You look at our pre-K through 12. You look at the schools. You look at the school construction program that we have down in Worcester. And then you turn around, you look at the business incentives, getting rid of the dispensary in Worcester County, which put significant money back in play in the hospitality industry or school after Labor Day or farming that we've already talked about. These pieces of legislation, I got a whole bunch of them right here. We can go right down. that modestly, I've been able to sponsor. I've been able to sponsor in a bipartisan way with leadership from Western Maryland, the George Edwards, Republican George Edwards, Crossfile, Carl Anderton over right here out of the district. So, you know, this is about a team effort. And yes, the leadership of the governor has been solid as we've gone through. But with all due respect, and I say with modesty, my leadership has been tremendous. And each year, our success rate gets better in the General Assembly, and we continue to go forward. Now, as a senior member in Senate Finance, and we go back. Look, I lost my chairman on primary day. And he was one of the, as they say, the last working farmers in the Maryland General Assembly. I have to make sure that I sustain that voice, as I talked about in that caucus. I sustain that voice effectively. So, you know, this is about being accomplished. People know me. I don't stay in any one office too long. And I've been there to work for the people. I continue to do that going forward. So as we go, yeah, it's great to work with the team. I'm going down from here. We're going to walk with Governor Hogan on the boardwalk. And as I said earlier, I really thank him as an ally coming in for that convention center project down there. So we've done a lot of good things. We've worked well together. I've supported every one of his nominations. I'm on the Executive Nominations Committee, the subset, and it's really great to be there, the subset of the Senate, when you have a new administration and you have the Secretary of the Environment or Transportation. They come and you have a conversation to earn your vote as a member, my vote, and it gives you that relationship to build for the needs of our people here on the shore. So it's a great composite of leadership. That's what we've been able to achieve. That's what I'm looking to sustain. But I need your listeners' vote to do that, and I asked for it this morning.
So it's always been close. Is it going to be close this time?
Absolutely. You know, if one's a landslide, we're working to get all the rest and then get that one. And folks out there, I ask for your continued support. But we take nothing for granted. And people know they call me night or day, and I'm there. Constituency service is really the most important. Legislation is certainly our policy, but constituency service. You know, I'll kind of end it here. I was over at the Wicomico Yacht Club, the boat docking competition they had. The fella came up to me and he introduced himself and his significant other, and they said, "We want to thank you." And as they got ready to say, they both teared up. And I remember the call. It was this winter. They had a teen, we'll leave it at that, that had significant behavioral health issues, mm-hmm. and really had found what they thought was going to be a road to violence, whether it was against them or against themselves. And we jumped right into action, and before the night was over, we found a pathway. Those are the type of things, they're not written down as bill numbers, but they make a difference in people's lives. When you have an elderly family member that needs hospice care or really needs a second opinion, things just aren't working out, and you're able to show and help and lead them there, that's why I do what I do, and that's what this is all about.
We've been speaking with State Senator Jim Mathias. He is up for, of course, re-election. His Republican challenger is Delegate Mary Beth Carrozza. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you, Don. Have a great weekend. And you and everyone out there.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. There could be a new political party in town. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's called the Bread and Roses Party. Jerome Siegel says he submitted 19,500 signatures to establish it in Maryland. Hopes the party will be able to run candidates by the next general election in 2020. Siegel himself made a bid for the U.S. Senate and Democratic Party, but was unsuccessful. We have him on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So describe for me the Bread and Roses Party. And in fact, that particular phrase has a certain historical significance, as I understand it.
That's right. That's right. The phrase Bread and Roses actually comes from a very famous strike of textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912. And many of them actually were immigrants. It was the largest textile cluster of factories in the world. And it was a major strike. And at some point in the strike, women textile workers emerged as a distinct force and I think captured the public's imagination. And they marched under a banner, I think, that had never appeared before, which was Bread and Roses Too. And that, no one has exactly known ever, I don't think, what roses means, but it means something that goes beyond bread. And in our interpretation, bread is basically the aspiration for a decent society in which people's needs are met irrespective of income. Everybody makes a contribution and so forth. And in many ways, it's similar to what a lot of progressive movements are about today. You can identify it with, let's say, the objectives, if not the specific policies advocated by Bernie Sanders and people who are called, you know, socialists in the Democratic Party. But roses is really something that goes beyond that. And we identify roses as being beauty, meaningful work, and expanded leisure to do those things in life that are really important. And a lot of this links up with a book that I wrote called Graceful Simplicity, the philosophy and politics of the alternative American dream. And this came out of the simple living tradition and issue that was very much of interest in the late 1990s. And I was part of a group called the Simplicity Forum of authors who wrote about this. And what I argued is that contrary to most of my colleagues who were interested in simple living, the reason that Americans were focused on higher levels of income wasn't that they were suffering from some aberrant consciousness or excess consumerism, as much as it was that in the United States, it's extraordinarily expensive to meet very basic needs, and that what we needed actually were social and economic policies that would make the United States user-friendly to people who wanted to live a simpler life, rather than expecting them to form a counterculture, rather that our mainstream policies should be making it feasible to live what I call the alternative American dream, which is to live, you know, relatively modestly with abundant leisure, creativity, and time to do those things in life that were really valuable, and were pluralistic as to how people will fill that in. And many, many simple living traditions, the Puritans were very different than the Quakers, and the Quakers were very different than Thoreau. And so all of that, you know, is American diversity, but what it had in common was the idea that getting and spending wasn't the central part of life.
Let me ask you this. So you've described as this party as being socialistic. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that we try to be very clear about what our ideals are or our objectives. But we want to get away from rather dogmatic baggage that was part of different phases of the socialist movement as to how to get there. So, for instance, not particularly enamored by the idea of social ownership of the means of production, very much committed to something that Karl Marx articulated in his distributive formula, which was to each according to his ability, rather from each according to his ability, to each according to their needs, which in our interpretation means that it's a social contract, that everybody has to make some contribution to society. Doesn't have to be paid employment. It could be in the home. It could be volunteer activity in the community. But everybody makes some contribution, and really from their deepest abilities. They really try to nurture their deepest self and their deepest values, and they bring them to the community, whether it be paid employment or not. And in exchange, their needs, they have the wherewithal to satisfy their core economic needs, regardless of what their income level is. And that may take the form of, you know, Medicare option for all. It may be something that can be completely satisfied just by, a $15 an hour minimum wage, or it may require totally different kinds of programs. And what actually is required, there's no single answer. You have to actually work through the specific categories of need. And the most useful thing to do is to work off of the household budget and ask, what are people spending money for when they spend money in the things that the government collects information about? Like, we have a category called housing. And the question is, well, what's the real need in housing? Well, our view is actually that what people are spending money for in housing is much more than physical shelter. What they're really seeking is access to good neighborhoods, meaning neighborhoods where it's safe enough to tell your kids confidently, go out and play. And also there's good access to free public schools. And that's what drives people in the housing market. But the thing is, if that's the need that people have, even income growth, even equitable income growth, isn't going to solve it, because it's really a supply problem. It's the fact that there are very few neighborhoods in America that give you that level of free public schools and public safety. Inside the Washington Beltway, there are a few, but it probably costs $700,000 to get a house there or more. And if you raised everybody's income, all that would happen is that you'd have 10,000 people in an auction the first time a house came up for sale in that neighborhood. And the price would go up from $700,000 to $2 million. until basically you have the market clearing price. So there's some problems that you cannot solve through the market. You can't solve it even with greater equity. You need something else, which is a totally different approach to neighborhoods. And what a lot of people make is what economists call the fallacy of composition. They look at what works for one person, and they project that onto the society as a whole and say we have to have policies that promote that. So, for instance, in neighborhoods I'm talking about, as an individual, what people try to do is to get enough money so they can escape. And that does work for the individual or family that escapes, right? They go from up the ladder. But the whole neighborhood can't escape because there's no place to go to. And the bottom of the ladder can't get up to the top of the ladder without pushing people down to the bottom of the ladder. So you have to have totally different kind of approach to certain kind of problems. But adequate food and clothing actually is the direct opposite. That's largely been handled in the United States through technology and agricultural revolution and so on. So it's all very different, and it has to be looked at very carefully in terms of specifics with a lot of policy creativity. Well, this is very outside anything that I'm familiar with as part of the socialist tradition.
Let me ask you this, Jerome. How do we get from, say, this predominance of certainly a marketplace, and we even saw with the Affordable Care Act was dependent upon the marketplace, even though we had government subsidies going to people to buy health insurance. How does one go from that to some of the solutions that you're talking about? I mean, it seems the market is very, very sticky when it comes to that kind of change.
Yeah. Well, we're actually not opposed to marketplace solutions. So, for instance, with respect to poverty, and that's the way in which I mean that we're not dogmatic, and we're really looking to redefine political identity, not the way it's done in America, which has to do with your focus on means. So, you know, if you view big government as a solution, you're designated on the left. If you dislike big government, you're on the right. Well, you could be committed, for instance, to wanting to really solve the issue of poverty in the United States. And to me, that's the core of political identity. It's dedication to certain kinds of social objectives. And within that, you know, it's, to me, completely pragmatic as to whether or not the best approaches are Lyndon Johnson's The Great Society or Richard Nixon's the Earned Income Tax Credit. And the truth be told, the Earned Income Tax Credit, which just basically puts cash in the pockets of low-income people at tax time, it's a reverse. It's a refundable credit, and the IRS sends people a check. But they then take that money, and they go out into the market, and they spend it on what they want, and there's no government bureaucracy running it. Well, that has actually done more to reduce poverty in the United States, I think, than anything that was part of the Great Society programs. So I think it's wacko for people to identify who they are politically, basically with, oh, I line up with the Great Society, or I line up with the Earned Income Tax Credit. The question is really to be open, experimental, pragmatic about what works, but to be dedicated, truly committed to solving certain key problems. And part of what we've got in the United States is a phoniness about a commitment to problems. So a lot of the people who say, oh, well, you know, we're for market solutions, or we're for doing things through the states, in truth, aren't committed to solving the problems. But doing things through the states is exactly appropriate. Now, as John Dewey spoke of the United States in those days as having 48 laboratories within which we could experiment and learn how to overcome better key problems that we might all agree on. Unfortunately, what goes for, you know, turning it over to the states usually is really a way of turning away from dealing with your problems. So we saw, like, for instance, with Medicaid, when they turned it over, you know, the states had a lot of discretion. And then you had these crazy Republican governors who basically are so, you know, disinterested in dealing with the poverty of their own state citizens that they actually rejected what was available to them to transform the health insurance situation of people in their own state that will be funded by the government as a whole, you know. So that's a kind of phoniness. But if you've got people who are genuinely committed to dealing with these things and want to do experiments on the state level, I think it's exactly a good way to go. Let's learn from that, And if we do learn something comprehensive, it can be duplicated across the country, either on the statewide level or at that point go national.
Let me ask you this. Do you make a distinction between liberals and socialists? I'm actually reminded of something that occurred, I think it was during the presidential campaign, when Hillary Clinton was talking about health care, and she noted, she said, well, we aren't Denmark, referring to the socialist programs there. Is there a difference between liberals and socialists or socialistic options?
Well, you know, of course, socialist depends on what you define it,
right.
What you define it as. My, when I said I identified with the early Marx, okay, I think that it's in the early Marx that you find the best understanding of capitalism. And I define socialism as something that believes in two things. One, the distributive principle that I talked about before, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And then secondly, believes that there's something better than capitalism, or that capitalism has played its historic role, and now it's time to go on to something better, okay? But the question is, well, what do you mean by capitalism, right? And there's a lot of confusion about that. Capitalism is not free markets. It's not industrialization. It's not, you know, trade. All of that existed independent of capitalism, some of it before capitalism, some of it thousands of years before capitalism. Well, capitalism is what Marx talks about in the early manuscript on alienated labor. And he uses alienated in the sense of to alienate, the verb to sell. And what capitalism is what happens when the way we produce things goes from a level of tools that could in principle be owned by master craftsmen, and they would have apprentices in small shops and produce things, to modes of production that are so massive and extensive that it's impossible for any worker or craftsman and so on to own the tools. So what you have is this division between entities that really own the tools, which are factories and plants and international supply chains and so on, and everybody else. And the familiar distinction today is between people who call themselves job creators and the rest of us who are preparing for jobs, in the job market, preparing resumes, pushing our schools to equip our kids better to get that, and so on. All of that is the job system. And it's only been around for about 200 years and doesn't even exist in much of the world, and has only become dominant in the United States in the last, you know, century and a half. And the job system is failing in a whole variety of ways. And even when it's not failing, it's deeply inadequate, because what it does is it separates the individual's deepest abilities from what he actually does in his work. His work is defined by the job creators. That is, they determine exactly the scope of the job, the hours, the framework, the nature of the product, the contribution that the individual will make, and so on. And that's the fundamental alienation of the job system. Now, the word that gets the alternative historic word for the job system in classical Marxist economics is capitalism. It's basically, but you start talking about capitalism and people's eyes glaze over. You talk about the job system and how do we get beyond the job system, and you reduce something to what I call its wonkishness. It's the kind of thing that people in Washington get their teeth into. For instance, how well is the job system working? Is it going to continue to work? What's the crisis in the job system? Is our current job system distorting what we do with schools? And this is one of the things that I explored in my Senate campaign in the Democratic Party. We did polling, very deep polling, asked the kind of questions that nobody ever asks voters, and we got extraordinary answers. For instance, just on this topic, I put one question that we put forward is, what do you think about the following point of view, which is that it's totally understandable that parents concerned about the limited potential over the long run of there being good jobs for their kids turn to the schools to better equip their kids to compete in a market of declining supply of good jobs. Well, that's totally reasonable on a personal level. Unfortunately, as social policy, what it's doing actually is it's resulting in the kids being under incredible stress. It's driving the family crazy, and it's distorting the schools. It's distorting the schools away from their educational function and from really important things like teaching history, the humanities, and the arts. Okay, and we said, what do you think about that perspective? Right? 35% of Democrats said, I totally agree. I absolutely agree, right? Well, I was flabbergasted. Who knew? I thought that was the most minority position in the world, because you go and you listen to the gubernatorial race, which I've done, and everybody is chattering about schools and education. They make no difference between schools and education. They don't even seem to be aware that there's a difference between what education is really about, real education, and whatever you make schools do, you know. And a third of the Democrats in the state already think that what we're doing is crazy. And believe it or not, another 40% said, I agree somewhat. So it's like 75% knew that there was substantial truth in this framework. And only about 15% said, you know, I disagree. And it was so revealing to me that on the one hand, the public, when you probe them with a subtle question, actually is very clear about understanding that we're on the wrong track. And yet it's not reflected in public discourse, public campaigns at all.
Do you think
Chris Rose's speaks really to deepen political discourse by actually engaging voters at a deeper level of what do they mean by the American dream? You know, what are their real values? What are their real aspirations for themselves and for their children? And when you do that, you find that, you know, American political discourse almost is like floating in the clouds, really detached from people's deepest aspirations and values.
Let me ask you this, Jerome. Do you see the landscape changing? I mean, one of the things that struck me is that as we move further and further away from the Cold War and what seemed to be symbols during the Cold War of socialism, i.e. various communist countries, do you see that shifting? We had, for instance, they obviously Occupy Wall Street created a certain strong chord for Americans. What do you see the landscape shifting now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders played, you know, a really great historic role. I think Donald Trump did also, but in different, you know, ironically and in different ways. But what Bernie demonstrated is that for what I call bread, that is the decent society, right, it's possible to mobilize tens of millions of people around that. Bernie's definition of socialism, I think, wasn't even serious for him. I mean, he defined socialism basically, you know, in terms of U.S. liberal, basically, you know, a liberal agenda. It was basically, you know, the New Deal and so on. But it's important. It's vital. It's decency. It's bread in terms of its objectives, right? And what Bernie showed is that it's possible to mobilize millions of people about that passionately and to win elections and to raise vast amounts of money. And he's moving the Democratic Party, I believe, you know, much more forcefully to engage the long overdue agenda, which is shameful. And I think he's right. He talks about it as shameful, and he talks about the way in which the United States fails to do things that are done in every other industrialized country, you know, in the democratic world, let's say. Okay? So he's right about that, and there's a change there. But it's limited. Okay? I characterize it sometimes as, you know, as narrow, shallow, and uncreative, but absolutely necessary. Absolutely is necessary. And what Bren Rose is about is going beyond that. And when I say narrow, by the way, part of what I mean is that it's so U.S.-focused, there's no international dimension. And just to get this off my chest, in the Democratic primary, right, I was running against Ben Cardin. And half of what my campaign was about is just what we're talking about. But the other half was about international issues. And Cardin's real contribution, or miscontribution, in the Senate is in international affairs. At the time, he was a ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, and he was APAC's guy, APAC's representative, the joint drafter of legislation on anything in the Middle East that bears on Israel, including Iran. Right? He was one of four Democrats who crossed the aisle and voted with all the Republicans against Obama's nuclear deal, knowing that this is Netanyahu's game plan for an American attack on Iran. And so this is the Democratic leadership. And here's the thing. Not one progressive organization in Maryland endorsed anyone in the Senate race. And here I had taken on the only time in American political history it had happened that somebody singled out someone in Congress, a sitting member of Congress, who was APAC's chief guy, right? The main guy that was the communications belt between APAC and the Israeli embassy and members of Congress, right? And went after him just for this kind of mindlessness on a whole variety of things, whether it was the vote against Iran, whether it was his determination to keep the UN Security Council out of Middle East issues, or it was his crazy legislation, his so-called anti-BDS legislation, which would have felonized anybody boycotting Israel or Israeli settlements over anything, by the way, not just over settlement building. Cardin's legislation would have made it a 20-year felony to boycott Israel if Israel decided to kick out the Palestinians. There were no exceptions as to what the cause of this could be. And he got 50 senators to co-sponsor it, right? Thoughtless, mindless, bizarre for liberals, right? Takeover of all our thought processes when it comes to Israel and the Middle East. That's APAC's influence. And it's a disease. I talked about it as mental corruption of the Senate, right? Okay, not one progressive organization endorsed. And believe it or not, the Washington Post never mentioned this part of the campaign. In fact, it didn't even cover the Senate campaign at all. I went to Bernie Sanders' office early on, hoping to get an endorsement from him. They wouldn't let me see Bernie. They said, go talk to Our Revolution, the spinoff thing. I went to Our Revolution. I joined the Montgomery chapter. And so when I spoke at meetings, I talked about the embarrassment of a progressive organization not focusing on international affairs. I got a resolution through Montgomery County chapter of OR unanimously telling state OR, wake up, engage in this race for the U.S. Senate and endorse a candidate on the merits. It has to do with me in particular. I actually had six other people running against Cardin, including Chelsea Manning, right? But it said, engage in this and endorse someone. And you know what state OR did? Completely ignored it. And I made so many entreaties to national OR, you know, about this, and they completely ignored it. So Our Revolution actually completely abandons foreign policy, right? That's what I mean by the narrowness of, you know, what calls itself progressive politics or socialism.
Finally, I wanted,
the shallowness, and there's a lack of creativity. That's and there's a political culture that we want to get away from.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, so what do you see as the purpose of this party? Because in order to create parties, in order to establish them, yeah. I mean, that's like you've got to organize on the ground. It takes a lot of effort. There's only been one successful third party that we've seen. How do you see the role of your party?
We're trying to invent a new model of a political party. I'm 74 years old. I am not planning, to recreate, the Socialist Party of America with Norman Thomas at its head or Deb and so on. Basically, I'm thinking about going something, the Bretton Woods electoral platform. And what I really believe is that in America, the real arena, free speech arena, in which people change, in which people dialogue and so on, is electoral politics. So if you really want to talk to people and you really want them to listen, you do it within the context of elections. And that means you've got to put people on the ballot. But it doesn't mean that winning is what it's all about. What it's all about is the campaign, right? The campaign is when you talk to people. The campaign and the possibility of running on this, that is the way in which you not only, put your own ideas out there, you affect the thinking of other people. You affect the thinking of the Democratic Party as to, how will they respond if Bretton Woods puts up a counter candidate? How do they build our stuff in? So some of it is actually affecting stuff inside as well as on the right. So we're prepared to, to speak to Republicans and to speak to independents. We don't see ourselves as merely, doing an inside the Democratic Party thing across the board. But what we see is really something that's relatively nimble. We need a new way for parties to choose their candidates. The thing that I saw in this endorsement process with these ridiculous questionnaires, all these progressive organizations, they spend their time, it's like college. They spend their time writing these questionnaires, and then they submit these questionnaires, and then they evaluate the questions. Like, that's not how you find out whether or not somebody, you know, is a political leader worth supporting. You know, you send them that questionnaire, and what does Cardin do with it? He says, all right, who on my staff is not busy? You go to the Congressional Research Service, and you go to the Congressional Budget Office, and so on, and whip me up within 72 hours the best answer to this questionnaire that'll affect this particular group, and we'll send it to them. And then the group takes all that seriously and runs that again, a similar questionnaire sent to somebody, you know, who grew up in the streets, you know, and someone is entering political office for the first time. You know, it's crazy. It's just crazy. So we're looking for new ways of selecting candidates and bringing in new kinds of candidates, different kinds of expertise and so on, but with a different political culture, but very clear on our ideals, very clear that we have a different concept of the American dream. One that, by the way, in this polling I was telling you about, we found that over 70% of Democrats in Maryland said that their American dream actually involved modest levels of consumption. It involved, you know, being able to have their needs met and having enough leisure to do the important things in life. It wasn't, you know, I want to be like Trump or I want to be in the top 10% or any of that, you know. And that's really fundamental because, you see, if the American dream really is not what all sorts of people have been telling us it is, for instance, oh, that each generation will do better than the preceding generation. Well, where is that written in stone that that's the American dream? I don't think that's the American dream. I don't think American history sustains that. You know, these guys are often talking about the dream of people in Europe who heard that the streets are paved with gold and came to the United States. But that's not the dream of the people who made this country. So my view is actually that if you get the American dream wrong, every policy across the board is wrong, because the touchstone for any policy making sense, right, is that it contributes to the pursuit of happiness in America the way people themselves understand it. That's what we had in the Declaration of Independence. And we've got almost zero significant discourse in the United States today as to what is the real American dream, or put differently, what is an economy for anyhow? How does what goes on in the economy relate to human happiness? And that's what our party is about. It's those issues and giving different answers to that than what's out there.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Right, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Jerome Siegel, he is attempting to establish a new party, a Bread and Roses Party, with socialistic goals. And Jerome, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks so much, Don.
Okay. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.